is URN
University Radio Nottingham.
Hello and welcome to The Pulse. My name's Rebecca and I'm joined by Ben, Connor, Maddie and Serena, and today we are doing a special Pulse. We're focusing on mental health, and to start off we are joined by Professor Chris Denning to talk about mental health. So first of all, just to start off, Chris, would you mind just introducing yourself? And we've asked you to come on today to talk about sort of your own experiences with mental health, and also in relation to an article that you wrote 2 years ago, and kind of like your experiences of working within a university environment. So just for our listeners, could you just explain sort of a bit about who you are?
Yeah, sure. So thank you to start with. Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a real great pleasure to be here. So I've been somebody that's worked at the university for a long time. I first joined in 2001 and I set up my own research lab. And then essentially over the last 21 years, I've built up my own group. I was promoted to chair, so professor in 2011. And then after that, I led a number of different large-scale initiatives around the university. And then finally, I became the director of the Biodiscovery Institute, which is the largest research facility that we have at the University of Nottingham. And I've led that since 2018. So that's a quick bit about my background, I guess. In terms of why I ended up writing the article, I guess that was because for me, a central pillar of pretty much everything we do at the university, we're so often driven by metrics around, you know, what have you achieved, what have you done in this way, that way, and so on. But what I've learned over the last quite a number of years is a little phrase that I like to use, which is metrics are gold, but people are diamonds. And in other words, to get anything done, really, you know, you need to have a really good respect. You have to have a really good culture. And then from that, the people who are embedded in that, if they're happy and healthy, then they're going to do a better job and you're going to get those goals that you want. And so when I took on the directorship post, this is one of the things I started to toy around in my mind. Should I start to try and write something in a position of leadership in the university just to try and start this conversation around mental health? And, you know, of course, because of my own background, reflecting on a lot of my own personal circumstances and then trying to convey that just to really start these conversations around mental health, which often aren't done very well. So that's kind of where it all started from.
Yeah, thanks. I also noticed in the article you talked about some of the responses that you had and how sort of like grateful many people were. Did you find the response quite surprising, and did it kind of like open your eyes to how like colleagues or students kind of felt about the issues as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, you know, because I think from my point of view, it was one of those things, you get an idea into your mind and you think, yeah, okay, I'm going to run with that. And as I said in the article, the truth is it took me about a year to pluck up the courage to write, well, even sort of start the article. And then it took a few months to then complete writing it. And what then happened next was I thought, right, I better beta test this. So I had a few very, very respected colleagues, and that was from PhD students through to people at the top of the university. And so in late 2019, I actually put out a beta version to them and said, you know, do you think this is okay? Is it something I should do? Most of the feedback I got at that stage was very supportive. One particular individual, a guy called Andy Winter, who used to be the director of campus life, he came back because he's blogged himself about mental health issues in the past. And he said, you know, the one bit you might want to just put behind a click is the bit about when I described my sort of feelings towards suicide. And he said, because if you don't do that, then you might get criticized for sort of shoving that in somebody's face if they don't want to know about it. So that was kind of the run-up towards Christmas 2019. And then you can imagine that in my head, I committed myself to launching this blog on the very first day back after the new year, which was the 6th of January 2020. And I have to say, I was absolutely terrified that whole weekend, thinking, oh goodness, what have I committed myself to do? And so I got to that Monday morning, and eventually, you know, I just got up first thing in the morning about 7:30, and I just hit the go button on it. And then it was launched, and I kind of sat back with a bit of bated breath at that stage, thinking, well, you know, what happens next? And some of my senior colleagues have said, you do realize that once you press this, the cat's out the bag and there's kind of no going back. And yeah, I certainly did realize that. But actually, it was just a matter of hours before the first responses started to come back. And I have to say, I don't feel that I've had a single negative response, at least not that's been voiced to me or said. And by far and away, the strongest feedback that I've had is thankfully not sympathy, because, you know, I didn't want sympathy about it. That wasn't the point of it. It was to start a conversation. But so thankfully, instead, it was far more about people coming back and saying, actually, you know, this does resonate with me. It's something that other people hadn't been able to talk about. But a lot of people were saying, because I was in a leadership position, because I had been open about this, it then gave them permission to talk about things more freely. And actually, it was after that that a lot of people started coming out of the woodwork and saying, well, you know, you might not know this, but, and then they would start to recount their own stories, And, you know, for reassurance to your listeners, I can safely say that there was not a single job family who were not represented in coming forwards. It didn't matter whether people were undergrad students, master's students, PhDs, right the way through to the most senior people in the university. And there are certainly people in the university that are above my pay grade, and they still have the same issues. So, you know, mental health does not care about gender. It doesn't care about the title that you might have, or your age, or your ethnicity, and so on. And I think, you know, we need to just start dispelling that this is something associated with certain segments of society. It's not. It's just absolutely rife all the way through. And until we start treating mental health as we would do, you know, you break a leg, you get some treatment for that, and you don't walk along and see a friend or a colleague who's broken their leg and then think, oh, I'm not going to mention that because there's a horrible stigma. Of course you don't. You ask them how they did it, you know, can you help? Are they on the road to recovery, and so on? And we really need to be in exactly that same situation for mental health as well. So I would encourage people to, if and when they're ready, to start confiding in friends. If they really need that help, then they start to reach out to the professional experts and so on.
It's really nice to know that you got such a good response from so many people, and also that those people, you know, were from like diverse backgrounds, and that you didn't get a negative response. I think that's really encouraging for people to kind of come forward with their own personal stories. And actually, Ben has a question for you.
Hello. You know, I completely just want to double what Rebecca said. You know, it is almost heartwarming in a way that, you know, you have had such a positive response. You know, having read the blog post, one of the most striking things to me was that, you know, one in four people will, you know, have some sort of issues with the mental health at some stage in their life. And sort of with so many people having it, you know, I just wanted to see if maybe you had an insight onto why do you think there is such a stigma around mental health?
Yeah, I think, and actually, you know, it's worth saying that we're kind of lucky in some ways in the UK and in the Western world, because we're at least now getting us to a stage where if you go to your doctor, they won't laugh you out of the room or go, you know what you're talking about, just get over it. Whereas a lot of other countries, they haven't reached that stage of the development and the understanding. And so I think this is something else that we need to be particularly mindful for our international colleagues. Certainly some of those people that I know, if they go to their own countries, they'd just be told, get over it. We can't do anything for you. And so I think, you know, I think this whole concept of one in four people is, it wouldn't surprise me if that's a massive underestimate, because a lot of people are still hiding this. And I think as we open up the conversation more, and especially post-pandemic, then it wouldn't surprise me if some of those numbers we start to find are 1 in 2, 1 in 3. And that means that unless we do something about it, then we're going to end up with an awful lot of people who are just not performing at their best. And in the worst cases, of course, those people will move towards a situation where they might even decide to end their own life. And that is simply that, you know, something crazy. We can avoid that just by having those proper conversations. And so I think you're right. You know, 1 in 4 is a very high number. Why that is so stigmatized still, I think it's because you just can't see it. I think that if it's a physical illness, if you like, you know, if somebody has got, I don't know, diabetes, and they have to inject themselves with insulin, that's now become absolutely plain and normal. But as soon as it comes to things that are wrong inside your head, if it's a brain tumor, then people go, oh, goodness, you know, that's really bad. We'll do something about that. But if there's something that you can't, or at least with current technologies, you can't see, then people just assume you've gone wrong in the head. And I guess in some ways that's historic because, you know, if you wind the clock back to 50, 100 years ago, if somebody had a mental illness, then they were just crazy. Or the old-fashioned experiments of sayings, if somebody went into a mental health facility, then often it was referred to as a loony bin. And I think those kind of historic terminologies just, they don't help at all. And I think they've left things with that stigma that we now need to overcome. So I think, you know, that would be my main thing. The more we talk about this, more it becomes normalized. So yeah, that would be my main comment there.
Great, thanks. I also just wanted to ask, so one of the things that I really liked about your article was that you your blog, you talked about like some of the things that you found helped you. Would you say that in a work environment, sometimes the help you can get can vary? And did you find that within the university environment that the support was very good? And I think lots of us are kind of, you know, thinking about going into the workplace. Would you have any advice on people who either, you know, might be continuing at university or equally might be going to a workplace outside of a university setting?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say is, you know, one of the things I tried to really emphasize in the blog is that the one thing I can be sure about is the solution that worked for me is not going to work for somebody else. It needs to be tailored to individuals on their own circumstances. But there are some generalizations that I think you can start to make. The way I wrote the blog was perhaps a bit different because I tried to make it a bit more conversational. I guess the inspiration I got from that is one of the resources that I've quoted in there, which is the book by Paul McGee, How Not to Worry. And he writes in a very conversational way around some of these topics. And one of the things I really liked that he wrote is the whole book is about how not to worry. And he says, but, you know, in some ways we're trying to fight a losing battle in how not to worry, because the whole point of our evolution is that we're designed to worry, because if when we were back in the cave, if you didn't worry about anything, then you would decide, actually, I'm just going to go for a wander out in the middle of the night into a dangerous area where there are known to be saber-toothed tigers. And of course, that particular person will go out and they'll get killed by the saber-toothed tiger. The one that's quivering away, scared of everything left in the cave, who doesn't want to go outside, well, he's the one that manages to pass on his genetics, right? And so we're almost designed over evolution to become these worrying, fearful creatures. And Paul McGee describes it in a really good way about the evolution of the brain has happened in these three main phases. You've got the very primitive brainstem that keeps the basic functions, breathing, and keeps us alive. Then you kind of have the emotional part of our brain, which just responds. And that's why if somebody makes you angry, instead of thinking rationally about it, you just have a flash of anger to begin with quite often. And then in humans, we've developed the cerebral cortex, which is kind of the thinking part of the brain. But that, as Paul McGee describes it, that's almost like the new kid on the block. And by the time this sort of primitive and the emotional part of the brain have kicked in, it's often before the more thinking part of the brain has got out of bed. And so what that tells you is that as part of the thing that we need to develop is to be able to harness that ability to think and rationalize more quickly. And so when people are starting to go into this depressed state and those primitive emotions start to take hold, the only real way that we can overcome that is to really sort of have the tools of that higher brain structure to override on that and then start to work our way through. And in some ways, you know, this is where the cognitive behavioral therapy really comes in. And one of the other resources that I mentioned here is the car map. And I really like that. It's, you know, you can just download it on your phone. There's a certain amount that's free and then that's subscription-based. But for me, it was 21 days of calm. And some of those, the lady who formed the company to begin with, she narrates it. And she tells a lot of anecdotal stories, and they're completely fictional, but they get across really, really good points. And one of those that she tells, which I particularly like, is about two monks, and they're walking along beside a river, and there's a damsel in distress who needs to cross the river. And so she says, "Dear monks, can you help me across?" And the first monk says, "No, it's against our faith. We can't touch a young woman." And the other monk says, "No, I'll help you across." So he picks the young damsel up. He carries her across the river, puts her down on the other side. And she says, "Thank you." He goes back and carries on walking along on his journey with his other monk friend, who eventually, after about an hour of walking, finally says, "Brother, I can't hold it anymore. It's against our faith to pick up a young lady like that. And yet, you know, that's what you did." And the other monk turns around and he says, "Brother, I put the young lady down an hour ago. You're still carrying her." And it's this anecdotal story about how so often we carry things with us for far, far too long. And often it's referred to as ruminating. And you think about something for so long that it just grinds you down more and more and more. But that ability to have that higher order thinking and snap out of that negative way of thinking is the way you can start to pull yourself back from the brink from so many different situations. So that would be one thing. And then the final thing that I would just say around that is if there's kind of what, in addition to the blog that I've written and the resources there, one other resource that I would definitely direct people to is one of the most interesting TED Talks that I've ever heard. And it's done by this guy called Daniel Pink. And if your listeners just plug into Google Dan Pink TED Talks, and if that isn't enough, then also plug in Puzzle of Motivation. It's about 20 minutes long. It's absolutely brilliant. It's about how to inspire people and get the best out of people. But as part of that, one of the things that Dan Pink describes is these three main characteristics that really drive people. And they are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So autonomy, the ability to have free will and free thinking. And the truth is, most of the people who are in the university setting have a reasonable amount of flexibility or that autonomy. And again, in the university setting, lots of people are learning and becoming better. So that fits into mastery. So those two in the university setting are actually quite easy, autonomy and mastery. Often when I hear about people, sorry, the dogs are going mad in the background. When I hear about people who are starting to struggle, when you drill down into it, what they're missing is purpose. They get to a stage in their life and they don't really know which direction to take. They don't know what's happening next and so on. And often it's that focusing on the purpose that is really, really important to bring people back. So often when I meet people who are struggling, sure, they've got the autonomy, they've got the mastery, but then you drill down into it and where are they going in their life? They've lost their way. And that was certainly true of me. That's where I got to. And it wasn't until I managed to find my inspiration, as it were, that I was able to bring myself back. So just a few thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's so true, that like self-reflection is really important, and also having a purpose. I mean, I think often that applies to people all the way through their life. No matter what job you do, that you always need to have a sense of purpose, and if you lose that, then that can really affect your mental health. We actually have one last question from Ben.
Hello again. So one of the things that sort of you mentioned just there as well, and also sort of was in your blog as well, is about cognitive behavioural therapy, and that, you know, that I really relate to that myself, because I also happen to, you know, undergo CBT, although I happen to go with Insight IAPT instead of Trent PTS, which is, I believe, who you went with from the blog. And so sort of what I wanted to sort of ask, you know, if you're comfortable, just a lot of the fear of sort of seeking treatment, at least for myself, was sort of the fear of the unknown almost, you know. So if you're comfortable, would you mind just sort of giving a summary of your experience, you know, going through CBT as sort of one treatment method, and also, you know, what you'd recommend to a student sort of seeking out that treatment?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm completely comfortable with all of that. I think being open is critical to this. So I'd say two things about it. The first is that, as I described in the blog, I went through, and the first major episode of depression that I had was in 2012. And after that episode, I had counselling and I was also on medication. And I think part of the reason why 6 or 7 years later, I started to slip back and then become ill for a second time was because I'd learned some of the skills through counselling and so on, but I didn't have enough confidence or knowledge, perhaps, to be able to almost lock in those learnings that I had made. And I think the difference that CBT was able to make is to almost take those lessons that you've learned through the counselling and then start to apply them through that higher order thinking that I was mentioning a bit ago. So what I'd encourage people to explore and at least find out whether it works for them is to make sure that, you know, if you want to follow the route of medication, then fine. Counseling, I would certainly get people to trial that as well, but then build into the cognitive behavioral therapy as well on top of that. For me, I think the more tools that you can learn and the more approaches you try to overcome some of the illnesses that people will be facing, then the more likely you are to find a combination that works for you. So don't just try one thing and go, well, that didn't work for me, that's no good. I mean, I'm still on antidepressants now. I'm on sertraline. I take 150 mg a day. I've been on that for the last 3 years, and I have no plans of stopping that. It's working really well for me. So I think making sure that people do explore those different things is the first thing. The second aspect is that I've spoken to a few people, and they said, oh, you know, CBT didn't work for me and counselling didn't work for me. And so one of my first questions to people who have said that, I mean, genuinely, it might just not work for people. But I think understanding some of the reasons why it didn't work for people are also just equally as important. And often my first question to people is, how honest were you when you went into those sessions? How much did you really open up? And some of the responses that I've got back are like, well, you know, I was a bit guarded in what I said. I went for 1, 2, 3 sessions. And then after that, the counselor said, well, you know, sorry, I don't think, you know, I think we've kind of come to the end of the road on that. I actually had, I think, 6 or 8 sessions with the counselor. And I think that's because I was prepared to be extremely open. And when I mean open, there was pretty much no facet of my life that I was not going to be discussing in that room. I mean, it's a confidential discussion. And for me, it sort of really did probe into parts of every facet of my life from when I was a kid through things that might have happened when I was very young. And this is probably why I think I suffered from depression as a kid as well, right the way through to personal relationships, whether they're sort of your partner, family relationships, and so on. And I think for me, I started to uncover some of the real core roots of why I'd started to become sick. But that was only because I was prepared to be super open about it with somebody in that trusted room. And I think if people can't do that, then they're less likely to be able to gain the benefit from the counselling services. Now, for some people, that is a heck of a stretch, being so open. But that would be my main thing. The person is not there to judge you. They're there to help you. And the best way that they can help you is if you're honest, you're open, and you're prepared to do some pretty hard self-reflection. But quite honestly, if you've got to that stage of getting to the counselor, well, good on you, because you've started to admit to yourself that you need help. And then the best thing you can do for yourself is, you've admitted it, that's, to be honest, the hardest battle of all. Once you're in that counselor's room, now's the time to let it go. If that ends up being floods of tears or just exploring things that you didn't think you were going to explore, then please do so. Just, you know, just end up getting the best treatment you possibly can.
Yeah, I think that's very true. It often starts, the first step is just, you know, you admitting kind of to yourself that you need help. And I think that's a really important step, as you say. You know, mental health is sort of more a case of baby steps and eventually sort of getting there. You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. So that brings us to the end of the interview. Thank you, Chris, so much for coming on and talking about your personal experience. For anybody who wants to know more about the blog, you can find it on the Nottingham website in the EDI blog section. It's called Mental Health, Time to Start a Conversation. So yeah, thank you again, Chris, for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. And I hope that if one person finds this helpful, then I'll be a happy chap. So thank you so much.
Moving on to our next section, more sort of a general discussion on really how to manage your mental health. As sort of we are a news section, we do have a news article to support. So as many listeners have probably seen, Hugh Edwards, who is a presenter for the BBC, recently opened up about his experience with depression, including, you know, being told by sort of the BBC newsroom, you know, that, you know, people don't want nutters to be reading the news, which is, you know, very sort of, not really the greatest comment to be told when, you know, you're sort of dealing with these sorts of issues. And so sort of moving on to more generally, you know, do you guys think it's important to talk about mental health more openly? Do you think that currently on the university, you know, there is a culture where we can talk about it openly?
I think it's certainly like moving that way. I think even just the story that you mentioned there, that kind of says a lot in itself, that such key figures that have had such a hard time in feeling like their mental health was stigmatized are coming out. I guess it shows that there are transitions taking place, and I think that hopefully things like that will encourage other people. And the interview that we've just spoken to Chris, and he's spoken about how important openness is, and it makes other people feel closer to one another. It's a way of helping out one another and also a way of helping out yourself. So I suppose there's definitely evidence of change coming about more recently.
I feel like there is something somewhat of a generational change, that people of our generation are typically seem to be more open to talk about it and be more willing to support their friends if their friend wants to talk about their situations. Whereas it, like, historically that hasn't been the case so much, and so people of old generations may feel a bit more reticent coming forward. And also feel like maybe there's sort of a position situation, like Chris said, and like Professor Denning said in that interview, it was important that someone in a position of authority came forward and talked about their experiences, because often it can be viewed as like, oh, well, you shouldn't be in a position of authority if you're struggling. But that's ridiculous, because people in any position can be struggling with these kind of things. And if not in a position of authority, has had experience with mental health difficulties, then how can they support other people who are experiencing them? So I think that it's important that people from all walks of life and of all ages feel comfortable coming forward and talking about it.
Yeah, and I think it was interesting also how he said in the interview that, like, he had people from all kinds of backgrounds come and sort of talk about their support for it. And sort of as you're saying, like, it's really nice, I guess, from like a student perspective, to have a professor who has like a personal understanding, because it just means that chances are they'll have a better understanding of like where you might be from, like the position you're coming from as a student.
Yeah, I think Going on from what you said about like the generational divide, I think that in a way that has its positives and negatives, because I think, I mean, the difference in the way that I hear, say, like my parents and people of their generation talk about mental health, it's, I wouldn't say it's better or worse, it's just incredibly different. I think that now it's recognised so much more as a health condition. And I think that although that's important and that's incredibly helpful for many people, because now they can seek help and they can recognise that it's such an important thing that really is impacting them, I think my parents and their generation, they see it very much as like, oh, it's something that I'm feeling that everyone's feeling. And because it's not stigmatised for them, I almost feel that it's not seen as much of a problem, which of course is a bad thing in a way, but I think that stigmatizing it also makes it kind of more uncomfortable to talk about. Now that it's seen as such an important thing, sometimes people are scared to talk to one another about it, whereas the older generation, because they don't see it as like this big labeled thing, they kind of talk more freely about it. There are no boundaries.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, it's kind of almost like a bit of a paradox. On the one hand, you want to draw the seriousness to mental health, but at the same time, you want it to still be kind of normalised to the extent that you should be able to have a conversation without everybody sort of being on edge. I mean, I think, what would you guys say? Do you think the support within the university is good?
I wouldn't, you know, the resources that are online on the website, they are really good. The list is very extensive, and there's sort of information about a lot of different situations that you can find yourself in, just from sort of from counselling all the way to sort of, you know, recommending, you know, what circumstances you should escalate it further with, say, a GP, or, you know, with various charities. The online resources are really good, but it's just unfortunately sort of the in-person sort of care, I suppose is the word, is just, you know, I've never... You know, say for example, if I had anything that I felt like I'd need to speak to someone about, you know, I wouldn't know who to go to at the university. You know, I'm sure I could find it online, but it's just not very personal. You know, it's not really sort of something that you walk in somewhere and go to speak to people. You know, whether that should be the role of sort of your personal tutor, I'm not sure. You know, I've not really had any contact with my personal tutor over the past 2 years either. You know, perhaps that could be a system which could be improved.
I mean, I think as Chris said, half of the problem and the most difficult part is kind of admitting and reaching out for help. And I think that that's where the university could really improve, because once you reach out, yeah, the services are available. There are people to help, there are resources to help. But maybe it should be people reaching out to the students rather than the other way around, because half of the problem is that people don't feel they're able to reach out. So I think that key people that are in contact with students every day, like personal tutors, even like wardens in the halls, they should be more assertive and they should be asking students about their welfare, as opposed to students that have the confidence to actually confront the issue.
I mean, with the exam period coming up for a lot of people, my own experience for talking about the university reaching out, like the lecturers and module conveners have all been very forward on, here's the process of how you do the exam, here's all of this and that. But throughout the swathe of contact from the university out about that, unless I've missed it, which is entirely possible, I've not received any form of communication from any section of the university about what to do to help manage mental health in an exam period. I think, you know, and again, I could have missed it, and that is entirely possible, but it is certainly concerning that if it is being done, then it might not be being done enough.
I think that's like very true, that it's very easy to miss certain things. Like, we all get loads of emails, I'm sure. Like, I get so many, and I find it quite confusing as well, because sometimes there can be a lot of information within those emails that are very, like, the information is quite diverse, it's about lots of different things, so that can make it a bit confusing when you're trying to go through your emails and you want to just find out where you can get support. You know, you end up like looking at another email that has, you know, just completely irrelevant information. So I think maybe it's sometimes just about getting very clear messages out there.
I think I completely agree, because, you know, especially with the point about the emails, you know, I probably only check sort of my, especially now that sort of university is winding down for the summer, you know, I don't check them as frequently. But it's just a load of random stuff from the SU mainly. You know, it'd be much clearer if they, you know, had a more sort of concise emailing sort of regime? Is that the word? Getting confused with words today, apparently. But it's just, if there was much more clear messaging, you know, perhaps even, you know, when you join the university, you just have sort of like a almost a welcome meeting saying, you know, here's the support, here's where you can find it. I think that would be really beneficial. Then sort of the problem with that is that you can't really do that with students that are already here without sort of, you know, almost doubling up the pressure on the staff. You know, it's just sort of a bit of a lose-lose situation, really. But I suppose as time has been passing, you know, COVID, you know, began over 2 years ago now, and that was sort of the dawn of what people would sort of term sort of a mental health crisis. You know, do you believe that there still is a mental health crisis that needs addressing, especially amongst sort of younger people?
I think there was a mental health crisis that needed addressing, particularly among younger people, before COVID started. And I think COVID made it worse, and I don't think that it's got better since. Like, even I was at university before COVID started, and we were talking about like a mental health crisis among university students then. So there was still like alarming evidence of an alarming number of people our age struggling with depression, with anxiety, with suicidal thoughts, and like all manner of mental health conditions. So I think that it's not all due to COVID. COVID did make it worse, particularly by increasing isolation, which is often a big trigger for a lot of mental health conditions. But it isn't just COVID. Potentially COVID has made it worse for university students, because it's meant that the number of resources we have access to has decreased, and we've been more on our own, and the universities have been so stretched that professors haven't been able to, and professors and other university workers haven't had the resources to reach out and help people. But I don't think that it was just COVID that was creating the problems.
I mean, I saw an article recently on the Nottingham Post talking about how the Nottingham Council was saying that the mental health services in Nottingham are failing. Like, that's the word they used, how it's just not good enough. And sort of it tried to highlight the steps they're trying to take to improve on it by bringing in almost £6,500 worth of funding for it. But I just wonder, you know, they were talking about the article lists that this topic came up in 2019, and unfortunately a lot of the problems were not addressed then, and, you know, unfortunately got a lot worse in the time period between. And I think it's just, I wonder, will this sort of injection into creating a targeted support for high-risk groups and creating a real-time surveillance data system really be all that useful for, you know, finding and offering the support to those that need it the most?
I think I completely agree with you there. Also sort of on another point as well, you know, one of the things that we discussed a lot in the interview earlier was sort of the stigma around mental health, sort of on campus, and sort of within university culture now, especially now that we're sort of all returning back after COVID. You know, have you guys found that there is any stigma on campus at all?
I think on one level, particularly following COVID, people were quite keen to socialise and things and speak, and maybe people have been more honest because of that. You know, I think COVID has affected a lot of people's mental health, maybe, you know, people who haven't struggled with it before. But I feel like on another level also, it's been an adjustment getting back after COVID. So it's kind of like we were saying before, even if you did know where to find support previously because of the nature of everything, like sort of transitioning back into in-person and things, where you can find support has kind of changed. And just having small things like contact with your SU officers is much harder, obviously, unless you're actually on campus. So I feel like in some ways maybe there's been more kind of dialogue about mental health, certainly on like social media and things, but on another level, you know, it's kind of difficult continually like transitioning between online and in person.
I agree. I don't know if it's just a personal thing for me, but I find online things so much more daunting, and kind of it doesn't feel personal in any way. And I think that personal contact is such an important feature, and maybe it's just a systematic issue that universities are so big that personal support would just be like such a challenging feat to cover such a large number of students. But I do think that having that personal contact from, say, a personal tutor, or like I remember even from my experience in halls in first year, in the blocks you sort of had a warden for every three blocks, and I mean, they were supposed to kind of check in on your mental health. It wasn't something that I ever experienced, or I actually don't know if they did. But I think that that would be, that's so crucial to their role, and that they should be doing that. And I think that personal tutors, I just think everyone needs that personal contact from whoever it may be that is linked to the university, because I don't think that an email is enough. And I think that so many people wouldn't have the courage to reach out over an email. As Chris has said, that's half of the problem in the first place.
Yeah, I totally agree that, like, it's personal contact that's important. It's just, like, it's so difficult to imagine how that can be done on such a big scale, like you say. It just makes you think that, like, the university needs to, like, support the people who work for it more, and, like, give them the resources that they need to reach out. Because I'm sure that, like, I meet with my personal tutor every term or twice a term, and I'm sure that, like, he would love to do more for the students that he's tutoring, and many other personal tutors probably feel the same, but they just don't have the time or resources to do it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of true, actually. It kind of links with the strike issues, that lots of lecturers feel they can't adequately support their students because their workload is just too enormous. And I have to say, like, I think that's kind of, I think you can kind of see that. And also, even within the university, I mean, it's hard for lecturers to have, you know, good mental health if their workload isn't balanced in a way that's fair.
Sorry, Ben, you go.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to add to Rebecca's point and say, I guess it's so easy as a student to think that the university is purely revolves around students, and that's such a selfish way of me to have described it, because really, I guess, yeah, the personal tutors themselves probably don't have the support that they need themselves, and the university is more than... It's a collaborative thing. It's not just us requiring support. It's everyone working together, and that's something that I definitely think can be improved.
I think I'm completely agreeing with you there. You know, especially, I think it's almost sort of a mindset that's carried on from sort of when you're in, you know, secondary school, places like that. You're sort of always the centre of attention. You're always there to be cared for by the teachers, who might as well just be these sort of, you know, sort of faceless sort of bodies of care, in a sense, if that's an acronym, if that's a sort of wording that makes sense to anyone else. But yeah, sort of, you know, as you get to university, you know, especially you sort of realise, you know, with the ongoing sort of strikes and the pay cuts, for example, is that, you know, lecturers themselves, you know, much like what you said, do have their own, you know, mental health issues to combat. And so I do wonder whether it's something that sort of the university, sort of the admin level, should be doing more to address, you know, by providing support for both staff and students. Or simply referring them over to, you know, somewhere like Cripps Health Centre, because speaking to your GP about mental health is also something that is highly recommended to do.
I guess the bottom line is that if we did want personal tutors to have a more active role supporting students with their mental health, the personal tutors would need to go to therapy themselves or have some other, like, proper support plan in place to cope with their mental health, which is what therapists and GPs who help people with mental health regularly do. And so, like, there would need to be just much more rigorous and a formalised support plan in place to help personal tutors if that were the case. And they would need to be trained in it, et cetera, et cetera. And there need to be confidentiality agreements. And those things just don't exist. So I guess maybe the answer is that personal tutors aren't necessarily the answer, and that it should be people who are more formally trained in mental health. Then the university would have to hire those people. And obviously they have the money to do it, but are they going to do it?
I think it's kind of interesting. Actually, we'll get onto this in, like, the next segment after a song. But there are kind of... I think what they're referred to as welfare officers. So in each, like, department, my understanding is that they have sort of designated people who are sort of trained to deal with the mental health, and the idea is that the personal tutor signposts them to this person. But I feel like part of the problem is A, people don't know who these people are, because also a lot of the university administration has now become faceless. So it's become, basically, they've moved them outside of the university, and people, you know, particularly after COVID and stuff, people work from home and things like that, so that you can't always actually get in contact with admin directly. So everything becomes a bit less personal. And if you've never met the welfare person before, you probably feel more comfortable talking about it with your personal tutor, even though they're not necessarily trained to do so. So I feel like maybe having some kind of session where you could meet more of the welfare people themselves. And like also, as people were saying earlier, about the welfare people need to come to the students rather than the other way around, because I think it makes it really hard and also confusing for students to go and find them.
I completely agree, because people... especially those that are in sort of, you know, as we sort of discussed earlier, more sort of the depression side of mental health issues, you know, they're oftentimes, you know, feel sort of stuck in almost a rut. And, you know, it's very hard for them to, you know, also from my own experience, it's very hard to sort of go out and seek help. And I think, you know, having sort of encouraging sort of more welfare officers that, you know, go out and contact students that perhaps have been sort of on a bit quieter than normal, you know, I think that would be sort of very beneficial. Hello and welcome back. And so, sort of, we'll be moving on to sort of discussing how you are able to access sort of mental health support at university and where to find support. Sort of kicking right off into it, as I sort of alluded to, the University of Nottingham website is very handy, nottingham.ac.uk. In the student services section, there is an entire page dedicated to mental health resources that are able to help you, because the university can provide some direct help through services such as the counselling service, but there is also a lot of support that you are able to get as well from the student union. So it's sort of, there's plenty of choice out there. It's just a matter of being able to find out where this choice is. So sort of the University of Nottingham Students Union does have a wellbeing guide popped out there, which sort of details who the welfare and wellbeing officer is, who happens to be a lady called Alice. And so it provides the contacts of her. And it just, so this guide, for example, which can be found at su.nottingham.ac.uk/advice/health-and-wellbeing, the PDF guide which can be found on there just details, gives a brief summary of a lot of different services that you're able to use, from student union advice to the university counselling service, to external services such as Let's Talk Wellbeing, such as some CBT services such as Trent PTS, such as Insight IAPT, or Insight Healthcare, I believe it's called now. But then there's also some other services out there that are across Nottingham, one of which is Nightline. Did you have something to say about Nightline?
Yeah, I've heard really good things about Nightline. So it's volunteer run, I believe, and it's primarily run by young people. So if you feel like, you know, your issue can only really be understood from a young person perspective, I feel like Nightline's a really good way to go. I think their motto is something like on the along the lines of like, they're there to listen, not to judge. So I
think what's really important about Nightline as well is, even if you feel that you're in a really good place at the moment, they're literally just there to chat. So if you ever wanted to talk about anything, if you even felt lonely, you fancied having a chat, someone at home wasn't picking up the phone and you wanted to have a chat to someone, that's what they're there for. So I think it's definitely worthwhile reaching out to them.
And all confidential as well.
Yeah.
Exactly. And additionally as well, sort of on the university website as well, another service that they recommend in addition to sort of Nightline is Together All, which is, it's a network. So it's basically, you're able to share sort of your experiences with mental health, and you're able to get advice from other members as well. And you can access direct support on Together All. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So that is, you know, sort of another option out there. And sort of as we're coming to sort of the end of the mental health special, the university sort of has a nice summary of 5 steps you can take to improve your mental health and well-being. Sort of number 1 is stay connected. So as we've sort of discussed a lot, you know, keeping in touch with your family and friends is, you know, crucial, rather than sort of slipping into a slump, which, you know, a bit of personal experience time I definitely have before. Know, getting out and speaking and acknowledging that you have the problem, you know, bang, number 1, it really helps. Number 2 is stay active. So the university has promoted UON sport as one of the things that can help. But additionally as well, you know, just simply having a walk around campus, you know, very blessed to have a very pretty campus. Simply having a walk around it, you know, if you're able to do so. I know I personally couldn't with my anxiety, but if you are able to have a walk, enjoying nature is a good way to, you know, keep on top of things. Number 3 is take notice. So this is more sort of staying in the moment, keeping yourself busy with hobbies such as photography. Yoga is one of the things they mention, you know, get your muscles a bit bending. I'm probably not well suited to yoga, as it turns out. Number 4, give. So sort of volunteering, you know, keeping yourself busy, sort of the way they phrase it is giving an act of kindness back. That is a really effective way to, you know, again, sort of stay on top of things. And number 5, sort of the last step that the sort of university has in the sort of quick summary before any sort of deep dive assistance, is just keep learning. So keep learning in the sense of learn a new hobby, learn some cooking, just have a bit of fun with that. But then also learning about, you know, the mental health issues which, you know, can affect you. Sort of the final thing really is on sort of learning is that one of the biggest steps to myself getting better with anxiety is just learning how the process of anxiety works. And that was, that was a game changer, believe me. But yes, is there any sort of closing remarks from anyone else?
No, other than I found out what the actual quote is. It's "We'll listen, not lecture" by Nightline. But yeah, I think those tips are really useful. Actually, also, like Chris talks about exercise and things, and his blog as well has a bunch of different tips that he found useful personally for him too.
All right, well, thank you very much for tuning into the Mental Health Special here at University Radio Nottingham. I believe this is a sports show.
This is URN University Radio Nottingham.